Bonjour and welcome to Sassy as Fuck. New houses, same us.
That's true.
For context, we've both moved house since we last recorded Sassy as Fuck. We recorded the first episode intro a few minutes ago. So we did that hit. We didn't address the fact that we're now both in different locations.
Yes. Yeah, we've bought our own office now. We couldn't afford many letters. So it's just fuck and the high street
side. Yeah.
So if you just see if you walk down any of the high streets, you will see our office building. It's a really tall tower. It just says fuck at the very tip.
We get a lot of confused tourists coming in. Cash in their hands and trousers around their ankles. It's very confusing. We get it.
Yeah,
I mean, just full disclosure, Alex is full of shit. And we're both in a... I'm in my office that's a lot bigger than my old office, which is good. You're in your new office, which I haven't seen that room you're in. You've been in this room because you came to my house over Christmas.
Yes.
For the Sassy's Fuck Christmas party, which was just us two sat reminiscing over old episodes. So I've been in, but I don't know what room you're in. I don't know how big that is. I don't know what the rest is. I can see a window. That's good.
Yeah, there is natural light in this room.
Yeah, we both have natural light, which is lovely. Yours, in all fairness, if I'm honest, looks largely the same as your old room.
It does. It does.
I wouldn't have realized you'd moved house if I didn't know you'd moved house.
Yeah. So I have some exciting news with that. Tomorrow. I made some orders on IKEA and I've bought a Hergen, I think that's what they're called, a table. I've bought a desk. So desk? It's the start. So
where are you sat now? You're on a desk, right?
I have a desk, yeah. It's not as good. Like, there's been a debacle of dimensions and that kind of thing. The office is nice. It's a bit bigger. But it's just trying to figure it out. So I'm building the office very slowly as we go on. So hopefully the audio quality is going to go up. You're going to get 4K version of my nose. Only specifically my nose.
I'm only at 1080 at this point. I'm only like, I know this is an audio podcast. So this bit is really redundant, but my new camera is 1080p, not 4K. I didn't splurge for the 4K one because no one watches. Not that no one watches, it's that we don't publish the videos.
I think I'm just getting overexcited.
So we both move house is what we're saying. Both
yes. House. Yes. Yeah.
I bought a house near a castle. You moved to a house.
I'm still renting. I'm renting. Yeah, in a farm.
In a farm.
Is
it in a farm?
It's yeah.
You're in a farmhouse. Yeah. In a barn. Are you just taken refuge in someone's barn?
I have, yeah. Nice. It's why my technology is so poor at this point in time. The internet's good. But other than that, necessities are poor.
Oh, you do have ferociously good internet, don't you?
It's aggressively good internet.
Not terrible.
Well, it's
not
amazing because, like, I feel like this is a tangent, but the UK's way of providing the internet, I think, is a con because technically we have a gigabyte speed, but on some days we have 50 megabytes of speed.
Oh.
And on other
this
days
is what
we
I
have
get
six.
Here.
Yeah. And then on other days we get 600 megabytes. Plus the router that they provide to you just is cheap plastic. So it already gets like demolished your speed.
Yeah, okay.
So
yeah, that's the thing. Like we've got a pretty like it's fine. It's 50 meg, I think. It's fine.
That's
the job.
Fine.
Like that's not. I'm not gonna complain about it. But right. Today's guest is Gillian Jones. She's a B2B SaaS copywriter. We had a lovely, lovely chat. It was really nice just chatting with Jill. We talked about the Story Hotel. Talked about autism and neurodivergence. Voice customer research, and we talked about Jill's hatred of cruisers, which we delved into.
Yeah.
And spoiler alert, I think I started to sway her slightly, but you know, listen for yourself. But yes, that's another great interview for 2023 that we recorded many, many months ago.
Yes.
But yeah. As always, our chat with Jill went over because it was a great chat. I don't know how much, we will try and edit this down, but this might be another quite long episode just because it's just a great chat with Jill. We really enjoyed talking to her, and we kind of consciously went, let's let this one over because we're just having such a great chat. So if it's a bit long, sorry, but not sorry. Bon appetit. Right, Jill, thanks for joining us on Sassy as Fuck. Thank you for joining. It's okay.
We can edit it out.
We can. Right. Jill, thanks so much for joining us on Sassy as Fuck.
Thank you for having me, John.
No problem.
Oh, wow. I liked it how Jill saved you. She kind of just jumped in and was like, oh, it's a pleasure. She kind of like held out her hand and said, it's okay, I've got you. I've got you at this point in time.
And even that was accidental because I've got my cue to come in. You know, like neurodivergent spaced out.
My tone just threw no cues off. It just kind of, it implied I had more to say. I didn't. So it's, right. Well, let's go straight into it. We have a list of notes. In fact, actually, when researching you, we're overwhelmed by the amount of things we wanted to kind of ask about and talk about, but we're limited to time. But it's lovely. The last thing you want when recording something like this is to research someone and go, oh, there's not really much to ask about here.
You see, that is exactly what I expected, that there would be nothing.
Really? Why?
Because I'm kind of like the antithesis of the LinkedIn person or the person that comes on Twitter or Facebook and, oh, hi, here I am in Spain. Oh, hello, here I am with my five children. Oh, here I am having a bagel and all of that. And I just don't give very much away about my personal life. A lot of the time, not because I think I'm important, because I just think, does anyone care? Does anybody want to know about that?
I have that same doubt.
Hold something back as well, you know, like that not everything is on the internet.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And it's definitely, it's a weird thing. There's a culture where some people get a massive following and they're hugely successful by sharing everything.
Mm.
But I kind of do, I'll write a tweet and go, no one's going to care about this. And just click delete.
Yeah, it's weird about what people care about and what people don't care about, because that reminds me of a post that I put on Twitter last week, and it went viral and it was nothing. It was just like me emptying my thoughts out onto a post, and it was bizarre. I wish now it had been work related. I could be on six figures by now, but it was something personal and nothing to do with SaaS or copywriting or anything.
Well, that kind of takes on, I think, maybe to the first question a bit of that. So we want to talk to you about some very interesting and important topics, autism, storytelling, copywriting, kind of, you know, a lot of important things. But I wanted to kick things off with something that is probably more important than all of that. What is your beef with cruisers?
Oh, that was the one, wasn't it? That was... Yeah, I asked... Thank God you reminded me, because I'd forgotten what it was. I asked people, was I the only person that found them repellent? I was. I worked in the NHS as a pen pusher, and before that, I was a teacher. This is my, you know, long eclectic 5-minute career here, there, and everywhere. And in there used to be women who'd gone on cruises, mostly women, and they were lovely people. But they'd going on a cruise was such a big deal, and it was like they have pictures of them sitting next to what do they call them? A champagne waterfall or something. You know,
it's like a big, like, pyramid of champagne glasses.
Pyramid of champagne glasses, wearing a pashmina. And the big deal about this whole cruise thing was that they got to sit on the captain's table. This was such a big deal. And I just thought, why? Why? Why do you care? And it just seemed such a stationary kind of holiday. I mean, I like to not do anything much when I'm on holiday, but not to that degree. You know, when you're trapped on a boat and you just sat there in a blanket or a pashmina. And I've got a friend who's been on one recently, and they were knitting and wearing blankets and scarves and just sitting on deck chairs. I thought, I'd rather be thrown from a building than do that on holiday. And it's not because I'm snotty. I know a couple of people that answered me sort of more or less accused me of being an inverted snob, but I'm not. I'm sure there are some amazing cruises out there. Thankfully, I'm not on them. So my feelings on cruises, I just don't like them. And I just think, why?
I both agree with you. Like, all the points you raised, I 100% agree with. But I also really want to go on a cruise. Something about it appeals to me. And I don't know what it is. Actually, my partner sent me like this. It's like a Disney cruise where there's just like Disney stuff going around. And it does appeal to me. And I can't put my finger on actually the reason why.
That does sound appealing, actually, a Disney cruise. But it's just, and you know what I find really weird? Is a swimming pool. What is that about? Jump in the sea. You know, you're surrounded by water, and then in the middle of that, you've got a massive swimming pool. It seems like that's not like the weirdest thing. Why would you build a boat with several floors on it and have a massive swimming pool in the water?
That is a bizarre concept, the idea of being like the amount of fuel it must take to transport that much water on water is kind of baffling.
Mm. It is, isn't it? In essentially what is a floating prison.
Yeah.
It's just...
It is. When there was that report, like, was it last year when like there was like a big virus went around a cruise? It did kind of look at it and go, that is such a horrifically kind of great way of highlighting the flaws of a cruise, where you go, well, all right, diseases on board. That,
oh, my God. Yeah, screwed. I'm being trapped in a cabin for weeks on end. I mean, that's actually happened. I'd go insane.
But at least you can go for a swim.
Yeah.
Can you imagine somebody coming in? I'm like, I'd be rabid. I would have just started eating the furniture or something, my hair standing on end, if I'd had to be locked in my cabin for weeks on end.
Oh, yeah, gosh, yeah, it's definitely like, because floating prison is right. Like, if anything goes wrong, then you're just trapped floating on the ocean, which is, you know, when you think about it, not ideal.
God, no. No, so, I'd find it repellent then.
So moving on to something slightly more relevant to the podcast itself. So on your website, you welcome the reader to the Story Hotel. So if Alex and I booked a room at the Story Hotel, what would we expect from our stay, and what are the breakfast options?
You would be interrogated in luxury accommodation.
Oh.
Where I would hone in on your story and use it to help your business look better than it did when you boarded.
The Story Hotel is on a cruise ship.
No.
It's a floating prison.
Story, that'd be a bloody nightmare, wouldn't it? No. Yeah, you'd come in and you could get to eat anything you liked. And I would basically because I just think, especially SaaS and tech, need better brand storytelling. But it's really hard to put that across because they just don't see why it matters.
You luckily could help me transition perfectly onto the next question. Why is storytelling important in copy, in your branding, in communicating with customers?
Okay, people may not care about your brand after they've bought something from you. It's like a temporary thing in a way. They love you for a moment and then they buy something from you and then they forget about it. But sometimes they'll come back. But in that moment, your brand story is important. And as long as it's important in that moment and it means something to people, it can be the difference between them buying something from you and not buying something from you. And it's not just about you, the person. It's about whatever it is that you did that made you start that business that resonates with the people who come to you. It's you creating something that is going to make a difference to somebody's life, however temporary. I mean, I know branding probably comes across as being quite, especially now, as quite, superficial and all style and no substance. But it matters only in that somebody recognises themselves. It's like holding a mirror up, isn't it? And if you have something really good, it's not... You could have the best idea in the world, but if it's not, if people can't connect with it and feel that it resonates with their needs or touches on their pain points, then you're not going to sell anything. And I think it is important. I think maybe brand storytelling has a bad rap, for me anyway, because I've seen so many personal brands wrapped up in the image and people wearing floaty dresses and staring to the middle distance and spilling out their personal lives. Brand story really doesn't have to be about that. It's about creating something that somebody else needs and you understand that need. And this is the road I went down to get it. And somebody having an aha moment and saying, ah, I need what you're selling. Especially if you're in a saturated industry, you've got to stand out.
The way you put all that was kind of, because I also kind of believe a lot in storytelling. I talk to customers and clients about this, but from now on when I need to explain that, I'll probably just point people to your description then, because that was exactly kind of, you put it very eloquently, because it's not just about, I tend to kind of summarize it in quite a overly pithy kind of, you know, it's about liking the difference between buying and not buying, because if everyone looks the same, a story can help you kind of stand out. But like you say, it's a lot more than that. It's about that investment, and it's about that ability to kind of build that kind of strong connection, I guess, that means that, like you mentioned as well, it's interesting that I kind of never think about in the same way, but it can be the difference between not just about buying or not, but also coming back. Because if you just buy something once, the story can actually bring them back to care, because you want to see more, you want to support that company, or you want to, like, for whatever reason that is. So what advice would you have for, say as a SaaS company, say they're quite new, a startup, for example, and they don't feel like they've got an interesting story to tell. What advice would you have for them?
I'd sit down and say, well, why did you do this? Why did you create this? If you create a piece of software, you create something because you recognised a need. But how have you recognised it? Is it because you had that problem yourself? You don't really necessarily have to have a big story, and it doesn't have to be personal. You can if you want to, but as long as there's something that you can, like, at that invisible thread between you and your audience, it's about really getting to know your audience at the back of your hand. Obviously, before you create something, you will have done market research to recognise that there is a need for it as you're creating, and knowing what is the first thing they worry about, what do they think about before they go to bed, what do they, how am I going to be able to do this, who are these people that is your audience? You've got to get to know them, and get to know them so well you know them like the back of your hand, so that whatever you tell them, whatever your story is, they're going to be able to connect with it. It doesn't have to be dramatic, and I mean, like, a SaaS company is not going to have much time maybe for a story that's all fluff and I fell over in when I was six and it was traumatic, all that blood that you hear sometimes, and if it doesn't connect in any way to what you're selling. But if it's, you know, I know that there's a need for this because my brother-in-law, blah, 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 or I know because I've had this problem myself so many times, so I thought, why don't I? It's also in the telling, isn't it? It doesn't have to have this big, massive, you know, an exciting story, but it's all in the telling and how you explain it and if it connects.
Yeah,
because it's speaking like you're speaking to other developers in tech speak. That does not.
And that we do that a lot. And unless your target market is exclusively developers, people do kind of, I think, get quite bogged down, especially younger SaaS companies. They kind of get bogged down and going, you know, they, like, the person reading it is going to be more impressed by the tech. Because when you first talk to people, they're probably their friends who are also developers in the tech space. And so they kind of make big assumptions that everyone using it will have the same. I think kind of when you're more technically focused, you focus more on features than you do about kind of benefits and storytelling. Mm. But mostly speaking, most consumers do care about that stuff more. You talk about the research side, so researching it and telling a story that kind of almost crafting a story that appeals to them. Does the storytelling itself have to be kind of authentic and true to work?
No, I don't think it always necessarily has to be true, as long as it resonates. I mean, when I say that, I don't mean make up a load of stuff about yourself, but you could create a persona because it has been done. I know I wrote about it on my website. You could create something that works or create a person, or as long as it resonates with your audience. I don't think it, I mean, what is being authentic? Are we all authentic? If I really think about what it is to be authentic, then we're all pathological liars, because you only have to go on Twitter to see that. None of us are really honest. If we were really authentic and we were really honest, it would be a constant stream of consciousness of complete misery and just hope. Because really, nobody is killing it, making it, look at me. Yeah, no. Nobody is like that all of the time, but you're constantly trying to make an impression on clients. So I'm not sure about authentic. I don't think, as long as it's something that has been created with honesty and integrity in mind when you're doing it, and something that people can relate to, and it really speaks for your brand, then yeah, I should say. It doesn't have to be about you and be completely honest. You can
effectively, the sentiment should be authentic, but the story itself, not necessarily.
Mm. Yes.
Okay.
Absolutely.
So can I move on from that a bit? So you mentioned on your website and Twitter, it's something you tweet about, so about being neurodivergent. Today you tweeted, no positives to autism or ADHD. I believe there are some. I have a quirky way of seeing things and I can get really deep on specialist interests, introvert and shy, but I watch people and developed quite an intuitive way of working. How do you think your ASD has, do you think it's had a big impact on the way you approach copywriting?
Yes, in both good and bad ways. But the good ways are that I think in the past, I learned to mask my symptoms and the weird geekiness. And I tried to pretend to be like other people, I thought other people wanted me to be. And I also learned to watch people, because I wanted to make sure that I was behaving like I was supposed to behave. Should I be in this situation? Should I leave the room? What, blah, blah, blah. And you become an expert on body language and on people. And I can be very intuitive on what mood people are in, what they're about to do next. I mean, it's not a superpower. I don't think, I'm not psychic, but you do become very, very good at being able to read people, even if you can't read a room. You can... It's weird, really. It's like quite a paradox, because I don't understand social cues that well sometimes, but I can read people and their motives and their behaviour very well. And that comes in very handy when you're a copywriter, because copywriting and marketing is all about people. You need to know people, and you need to know their motives, their passions, their pain points, their desires really, really well. And I know that people have done that to me in emails. It's a rare talent, and it's one I'm constantly trying to get better at. And I'm hoping that my ASD can help me to do that.
Mm.
You can read something, and it's like that person reading my mind. That's how good copywriting should be. Like, you can, yes. It's as if you are psychic and you can read somebody's mind. And also, like, special interests. I always call it that rather than superpowers, because it makes us out to be like the heroes, or like Dustin Hoffman in Rain Man spitting out equations. Yeah. It's not like that. I'm of average intelligence, but I've been exploring the term multi-potentialate lately, because somebody else was talking about it in a mastermind group I'm in, where you have lots and lots of special interests, which is why I found it really hard to niche down and specialise for a long time, because I'm constantly interested in different things. But whatever it is I am interested in, I can research it and go really deep on it. So that's another thing that's an advantage and a positive.
Yeah, and so I guess kind of that ability to do that research, that kind of depth, is that'll feed directly into the way you write, the way you communicate with readers, customers, things like that. So it's something that you've... Do you think that you kind of also able to write a certain way that is also kind of more inclusive, perhaps?
Yes. I mean, I'm probably more sensitive to being inclusive and thinking about difference and how I'm different. Because I always think, and I don't want this to sound twee, or...
It's fine to sound twee.
When you rely a lot of the time, like I do, on the kindness of strangers, you realise how important that is, and that if you don't take into account other people's differences, how can you ever expect anyone to take yours into account? There's an old saying that used to be quite cliched, and it was about how if you didn't look out for other people, how could you ever, when your back was to the wall one day, no one would care. And I always try to be inclusive and include everybody. It's a constant learning curve, isn't it, when you're writing at all, to make sure everybody is considered.
And do you feel that kind of the majority, do you feel like SaaS companies or the SaaS industry as a whole is currently inclusive enough?
I don't feel that they're anything a lot of the time because they feel so grey. But maybe that is my prejudice because for a long time I tried to break into SaaS and it took me a long time to come around to liking it because I thought, oh, it's boring, it's tech, it's acronyms. And that is probably a lot of what other people are thinking. So, but you realise that once you start doing it, and I'm starting to do more voice customer research and looking at key insights and stuff like that, you realise it isn't boring. It's really interesting because it is about people, helping them to do things quicker, faster, better. And it doesn't have to be a negative. Tech doesn't have to be making people's lives harder and people losing their jobs and people, you know, it's often seen as a negative, isn't it? But really, it can enhance people's lives. It can make people's lives better. And SaaS perhaps could illustrate that better in the way that they talk to people.
I think you're absolutely right. Like, grey is a good word. It's something that I completely agree. I've been like, in the SaaS industry for the last year, kind of copywriting, but for 13 years before that, I was a software tester working on it and kind of actually just using the software, testing it, making that thing. So I had a very different perspective on it. And you're absolutely right. Kind of SaaS as a term is kind of a bit an odd one because all it is just a way of paying for something effectively. Whereas actually each different SaaS has a different goal and the users a different goal. And actually when it boils down to it, especially when copywriting, you're not actually, the tech doesn't matter. It doesn't matter how you actually achieve the goal. It's about what the goal is and how it's, you know, and actually kind of the sense of, is it helping? You mentioned before about it kind of resonating with them effectively. Like if it's not something that has a degree of empathy or degree of like matching what they believe, they won't even notice it. It's forgettable. If people read copy and it doesn't touch on those kind of pain points they've got, it becomes largely irrelevant to the person. And then that's kind of one, like SaaS is a weird market for that, is that some people focus on the tech side, but actually it isn't. It's the people that you're selling to that matter. It's the problems you're solving. And so what you're saying there about it is that, yeah, exactly, is that it needs to be inclusive. It needs to be interesting because people don't use something because of the tech. People use it because of how it helps them day to day, which has nothing to do with the tech, actually.
Yeah, and does creating something that makes one aspect of your work easier, better, faster mean that you can do something more meaningful the rest of the time? How does it enhance? How does it improve things? I mean, it's for all, you know, even if it's work related, being able to knock 10, 15 an hour or few hours off your day means that time can be spent better using it to be with your family or your friends, and maybe spending less time on the internet where you can get lost down a rabbit hole and in arguments and shouts that you'd really rather not have found. Whereas if you use apps and tech carefully and all the stuff they can create and do for you, you can free up time to do something better.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's kind of, yeah, it's exactly, you're playing to what actually matters, which isn't normally the thing you're solving. It's normally what they then gain from solving it effectively. It's what you do. And you mentioned before about voice of customer research, and it's something that I think to a lot of copywriters, it's a big part of the process. But a lot of people don't know about it. So what is voice of customer research to you, and how important is it for companies to be carrying out?
It's fundamentally of great, really, really important. It's the nucleus of all copy. And I have learned this through courses, through reading, through... I used to struggle to write copy. And, oh, what exciting phrase can I use to describe this? And, oh, right. Copywriting isn't William Shakespeare. You're not a wordsmith. You're not reinventing the wheel. You're not... It comes back to what I said earlier about it being about people. If you want to write the copy, let your customers write it. You interview customers, you listen to what they say, and if it's a startup and you don't have those customer testimonials or interviews from market research and from, you know, talking to them about how a service has improved their lives or their business, then you go on to... You know, you review mining on Amazon or Quora or Reddit or any number of places where you can get people's opinions on stuff, because what they're saying is that the ammunition you need to write good copy, because their problems and how they solved it is how another reader is going to come on and think, oh, God, yeah, absolutely. And it's not always about copying what the customer said verbatim and not doing anything, just sticking it on the page. It's about using it cleverly, weaving it into the copy. Some of it you can use verbatim. Some of it you can use as quotes, or there's lots of clever ways you can use it. But it is your what your customer says and how they solve their pain points with your product or with a similar one is how you are going to get good copy on your website. It's not what you think, it's what they think. That's what gets people interested.
And you obviously kind of you believe in storytelling as a good way to communicate these things. Is do you look specifically for the stories that the customers tell you during the research, or is it more about using that to then tell a story?
It could be a bit of both. I mean, like, I was looking for an electric blanket yesterday. It's a completely different thing. It's not SaaS. But looking for this, some of the things people were saying were hilarious, honestly. And I always read reviews. I won't buy anything until I've read a good handful of reviews and looked at lots of different similar ones, the same thing. And some of the images and something. I can't even just stop laughing. It's hilarious. And you just think, oh, that's given me an idea. You know, if I was actually going to do, like, copy for an electric blanket company, I'd have so much material for that. You don't need to make it, oh, it's a fantastic product, this. Look at what people are saying about it. What matters? Well, it matters that they don't burn in their beds. It matters that it's reliable. What matters that it solves an issue, cost of living, too hot, penny an hour to heat up. Blah, blah, blah. Do you know what I mean? All the features and the benefits come from what the customers say. That's where it comes from. And that can be turned into a story or an idea for the brand, or the brand story itself. You can create something from that. It feeds into each other. You can have a whole host of ideas. I'm just thinking of an image now in my head. It's quite funny. I'm sorry.
It's fine.
You really find something funny in the car cop that you won't even say when I say it. Like this. I'm going to tell you anyway. Somebody dumped this puppet thing in a bin with the legs sticking. And said he might as well just go sleep in the bin because this blanket was so awful.
God.
How much time had he wasted doing that just to prove that the blanket didn't work? But, you know, from that you get loads of ideas, and it's just people are amazing. Mm. Even though I'm autistic and I'm terrified of them a lot of the time, I find people fascinating.
Yeah, and reviews are, they're kind of a really telling thing. Because genuinely, I think about 2 years ago, I was also researching electric blankets specifically. It's funny that you kind of mentioned that, because it's something that when I was researching it, I saw a review on Amazon where somebody went, we got the first one, it set on fire, but they replaced it, 5 stars. What? You can't go 5 stars if it set your bed on fire. That to me immediately goes 2 stars max, right? When it's set.
And here I am, the Burns unit for the second review. Don't.
Yeah.
Only third degree burns this time. Next time.
Yeah, I thought they went, oh, I'll send you a replacement one. No, I would like a refund, please. But somehow it worked. Somehow they went, yep, great. Got a replacement. This time I haven't set on fire yet.
With voice of customer research, I'm sorry to bring it back to boring questions.
No.
Alex.
Is there an issue if, for example, that you are that kind of customer, that your opinion might kind of influence the kind of research that you're doing? So let's say it's, you know, it's for an electric blanket, just as the kind of the example, and you are a proud owner of 5 electric blankets, only 3 of them are set fire, you really like electric blankets, and then you're kind of doing all this research, but you're kind of like already kind of embedding some of your own personal storytelling. Is that a problem that can happen with copywriting? Or is that a benefit?
This is a benefit. I would look at them individually and think, oh, whatever, or my thoughts come from looking at them. But I would also, I think you're looking for patterns.
Mm.
Good at recognising patterns. And, you know, if every single review that you go on says, I woke up in flames in the middle of the night, that's a difficult one, isn't it? If it's a good really good product, you're going to get fantastic reviews, and you're going to get plenty of things that you can write about.
Mm.
And hopefully, if you're a more established company, you'll have your own reviews and your own customer research to rely on.
Mm.
But
is it?
Yeah.
Is it better to have quite a bit of negativity because then you can identify the pain points of your product?
Yeah, well, you could say, well, if it was an electric blanket, well, we won't kill people. We won't set fire to you. our electric blanket has got fire-resistant ties, and it cuts off after so many seconds because not like these, ours are, and we've got 5 customers here who've used it, and they will tell you that you could have it on full blast for a week and you will still come out of that bed unburned and unscathed, because hot blanket doesn't burn.
I guess it highlights the benefits of, because you mentioned before about kind of looking at reviews, but it's also, yeah, obviously it's competitors as well as your own customers. And so it means that you can, if there are things that other, that your competitors are doing badly or getting bad feedback for, it makes great sense to lean into that and go, those guys over there are doing this. They're setting you on fire. We don't do that.
So many nuggets, aren't there? So many things. Just by listening to people and looking at what they say.
And are there any kind of tips or tricks that you... Tips and tricks annoys me. It's not... Because it isn't. It's techniques and things you learn and skills. But are there any particular things that you would recommend more SaaS companies do to improve the quality of their voice of customer data?
I suppose it's just doing what you ask them. Think about what you want to know and how you ask them. It's about getting the best answer out of people. Rather than questions that are just, did you like our product?
Yeah.
You know, like questions that are quite banal or just like yes, no. It's just like being able to ask really good questions and the right ones get the right kind of, juicy, interesting answers.
Yeah, because am I getting this right? Jen Havis, I think she's got a book.
I've got 2 copies of her book.
Oh, really?
The same one or 2 separate?
Same one. I ended up accidentally buying it twice.
It's that good a book.
Not that it matters that I've got 2, because I can't read them both at the same time anyway. But,
you could use one for highlights, couldn't you? You could really destroy one book and have it really used and marked. And
because that's I think that's got some good examples in there. Because you're right. Like the questions you ask is probably kind of the biggest thing that people often get wrong. Were they kind of asking things? Well, I know kind of that book's quite good examples.
I know why I've got 2 now, because the second edition is revised and updated.
Okay.
Yeah, some wisdom in what I'm doing.
Oh, do I need to check if I've got an old copy now? And I'm like, I got jealous. I'm like, hang on. Do I have the old version less information?
I don't know. I'm trying to look for the what do they call it? Whether you've got the chapter headings on it, but. Yeah, there is something in it, isn't there, about what to ask?
Yeah, no, that's great advice. Yeah, asking the right questions is definitely going to be a big part of that. And yeah, we can point. So if you're listening out there and you need help with asking the right questions, then buy 2 copies of Jen Havis's book. It's called Find the Right Message, I believe it's called. We'll leave the link in the show notes.
Yeah, Finding the Right Message, How to Turn Voice of Customer Research into Irresistible Website Copy. And what was happening in your life that made you feel you needed this product? That's a good question as well. And can use that question on thank you surveys as well. So that's a completely different thing again. Yeah.
That's great. It's good. Kind of voice of customer is definitely a good, strong thing that people kind of, I think, sometimes overlook. They kind of hope to kind of, they sometimes hope a copywriter can just kind of magic off their head some brilliant pithy line that'll sell their product, but actually it's like 95% research, 5% that'll work. So kind of moving away from the kind of the writing itself a bit, but you're approaching 10 years in copywriting based on LinkedIn. So I wanted to ask kind of how has the industry changed over that time, like marketing itself but kind of copywriting as well, like what have you seen kind of change in that time?
I think there's a couple of things that for me that I think are good. Like at the beginning, there was a lot of this sort of bro marketing. I'm on 6 figures within her, and I only work 10 minutes a day, and the rest of the time I'm on the beach and look at my Gucci sunglasses and look at this car. All I had to do was write a blog with one hand, and then that was it. But, and that is just somebody, and it's like the element of competition. Even though everybody says copyright is great, and they're really friendly, and they are the greatest, best venture people ever. But you can't help but be impacted on when you go on social media platforms, and people are constantly saying, "Oh, I'm busy now until 2028." Oh, I've got so much work coming in, I can barely turn around, spinning like a top here. And you just, please shut up. There has been less of that. People still do it, but there has been less of it and more honesty, more people coming forward and saying, you know what? It's not always a garden of roses every single minute of the day. Running a business and being a freelancer is hard, and I've never wanted to sugarcoat it for people. And I used to be accused a lot of being negative and having a bad attitude, but more people are coming forward and doing the same thing now, not endlessly whining and moaning about how awful it is, because otherwise why do it, but not to just constantly give off this perpetual image of constantly killing it, making it well. If people, I like it when people are honest and make themselves vulnerable, because it encourages, you know, if freelancers are coming into this for the first time, they need to know that it's not always going to be perfect. And I don't think it puts them off. I think it would make me want to do it more, because people are being honest with me about it and making people aware of the pitfalls and the mistakes and the things that you can do. You know, I've made a lot of mistakes along the way, but I'm glad I made them, because it made me the person I am and it made me stronger. And this isn't for the faint-hearted, and it'll either make or break you, but if you stick it out, it can be amazing. And the other thing I think that I've seen change is more neurodivergent people coming forward, and people who are different for a variety of different reasons, as well as being neurodivergent, being able to come forward. And, you know, you're seeing agencies now. You're seeing summits. There's one I've signed up for now, a neurodivergent summit. More people talking about being autistic and being a copywriter, people having ADHD. You would have kept that quiet years ago, 5-10 years ago. No one would mention it. But now it's seen as an asset. And there are so many of us in the creative industries and in copywriting and freelance writing and content marketing that are neurodivergent. And it's a wonderful thing when people are honest about it and able to talk about it and come up with ideas on how to do your job better and how to get things done and how to focus. And those two things are quite great. I think the emphasis on less killing it and standing next to a Lamborghini and all of the neurodivergent stuff and the people that are different coming forwards. I love all of that.
So that's interesting. Because I'm someone who got diagnosed with ADHD earlier this year. So I'm kind of in that, but I'm very new to it. I'm still trying to work out what it kind of means to me in a way, like, and especially because of, like, you know, I'm used to copywriting as well. So in the space of a year, I kind of went, right, copywriter, freelance, ADHD as well, crap. And I kind of get kind of torn on how much to kind of really talk. Like, I've been open and honest about it and talked about it on here before and tweeted about it. But I get torn how much to kind of, not necessarily embrace it, but kind of include it in my brand effectively, I guess, is kind of the kind of, 2022 way of saying it, because effectively it is. It's like how I portray myself online. Because part of me wants to go, you know, there are strengths here, there's benefits here, and there's an aspect that kind of helps my what I offer. But at the same time, I don't want to be just seen as the ADHD writer, or I don't want it to be seen as people going, like, you know, that's just his thing, or that's the thing, or, you know, or I don't. Yeah. I'm torn on that. Yeah. Yes, I don't want it to be seen like that's kind of, I don't know, like, gimmicky. So I like what Reese and you, like, you mention kind of neurodivergence and autism in how you post and what you talk about, but you don't, that's not your brand. That's not how you define yourself. But I guess I'm kind of struggling to find that. At this point, it is more therapy than really kind of a question or really podcast content. Just me going, it's good with admiration looking in Reese and you seeing how you've talked about it. It's helped me go, right, okay, that's, I can learn from that going forward to kind of help talk about it without it becoming like what I am. But I don't know, like, you know, without just being the ADHD guy, I can actually be that, you know, the give a fuck guy that happens to have ADHD almost.
Yeah, I feel like that. And I have wrestled with that for a while. I'm glad I can be more open about it, but it isn't all that I'm about.
Mm.
And I feel it has been suggested to me that I should make my brand about being autistic, especially on LinkedIn. And I have said no numerous times because I know there are people that do it and they do it well and good luck to them. But it isn't, I don't want to just work with other people who are neurodivergent.
Mm.
I don't want to just be seen as the neurodivergent person. It's part of who I am, and it always will be until I pop my clogs. But I am more than the sum of my parts. I want people to see it as an asset. I don't want people to see it as like a superpower, but I don't want people to see the negative. If somebody's thinking of going into freelancing and they see that you've got ADHD or autism or both, and they go, oh, well, I can do that. I bet there are loads of people in SAS who have either or both. And it's good to be open about it, but I don't want it to be part of my brand either.
Hmm. Yeah, I think it's a difficult thing. And I think there's also a risk there that if you kind of went, right, the autistic copywriter as like a brand name, the problem you're going to have is that the people who are less inclusive aren't going to hire you. So you're not going to help kind of level the playing field, help like the education side of it as much, because you're going to, because those people will go, and the people behind it are the people who are probably already inclusive. At that point, they probably already have, at the very least, an inclusive mindset when they're kind of running their business. And so I think by having it be, like you say, an asset and something that you can kind of point towards when it's relevant, mm. is a much better way of doing it, because you're more likely to then make sure it's, you know, it, you can have a more of a diverse client base, but also means you have that chance to kind of maybe inject that into places that wouldn't have already been kind of covered or included.
Yeah. Yeah. And I like neurotypical people. I haven't given up on them yet. Most of my friends are neurotypical. And there are a lot of people who, like you say, are inclusive and just accept me for who I am.
Mm.
And that's a wonderful thing. And I want to live in a world where we all partake and are part of things.
Hmm.
I don't want to just only be working with people who are on the spectrum or who are neurodivergent. I just want people to see me as more than just that.
Yeah, hmm. Yeah. I think that's it. We all have elements to who we are. Not what no one thing is that defines us.
Mm.
Hmm. So you've been using social media for quite a while. Yeah. How have you seen it change with regard to marketing your own freelance kind of business, as well as, you know, just how other kind of companies are using it and that kind of thing? Because you've got a brilliant kind of like knowledge of how that's all changed, having your freelance business start for 10 years ago.
It's changed for the good and it's changed for the bad. Mm. I think you need to have a strategy. And there are a couple of people on that I see on Twitter, and there's not that many, I count them on one hand, that are absolutely brilliant at using Twitter.
Mm.
I'm not one of them. I like to do personal stuff. I like to throw in a bit of work. Like LinkedIn, everybody has a different way of doing it and they still do well. Consistency is key. And I suppose in an ideal world, posting every day and preparing them beforehand is the best way of doing it, but I can't. My cat is meowing. Can you hear him?
Yeah,
it's adorable.
It is adorable.
He's part sign, practically on the cusp of yodeling. that's a name for a brand. yeah, it's hard to get your voice heard.
Mm-hmm.
And I think especially each social media platform, I think needs a different strategy because they will work differently. But I think I'm following Justin Welsh at the moment and he is amazing. I don't know if you follow him.
Who's that, sorry?
Justin Welsh. I think he's an American
rings a bell. Guy. I feel like I might follow him.
You want to follow him. He's so good. He does just two threads a day or one thread a day and that's it. And they get God knows how many go viral, all of them. And he gives such good business advice and good advice on how to what strategies to use when you're on social media. And I think, and tweets disappear, and I think threads are good. If I could just try and work out, it's just having the time, and that you really need to set time aside to do it all. And I'm just a bit hit and miss. But I think it's harder to have, you have to be so careful in what you say on there as well, more so than we used to be. It's so easy to say the wrong thing. I suppose it's just like Graham Norton said, is it's being accountable and realising there are consequences to what you say. So I come on there, I have to remember who I'm speaking to, a mixed audience, and I want to be inclusive and to promote my business with that is ethical and inclusive. I can't think of a word for that.
Accountability is definitely. Yeah.
Strategy is important.
Yeah. I think that's the thing. I think I speak for both me and Alex where I say that we're largely crap at social media. We both kind of go through bits of going, we should be better at this. Then we look at it and go, we should do this. Then after like a few days go, nah, that's not working. I'm in my best two week streak of actually being active, interacting, posting. Yesterday I managed to gain 20 followers by just having an argument. I don't understand really how it works at this point. I don't understand, like some things will work. Like I'll write a thread. But I used to think called Typefully now, which is very, like, that helps you write threads, but it also has good tracking there. But one thing it does is track is profile views based on posts. And I thought, like, and that's an interesting metric. You post something, who looks at it and goes, I'm going to look at their profile, which is good for, you know, freelancer. We want them to look at it and go, let's hire them. But like, the correlation seems baffling at this point. Just the most random topics will get people going, I'll look at his profile. But I'll post something about copywriting or about marketing, and no one does. People look at it and go, all right, they'll like it, and go, I don't care about who this person is, though. Whereas I post something irrelevant, and they'll click on it, and I get so... But consistency, you mentioned consistency, and you mentioned accountability, and that's kind of exactly... I think you need to look at things in a couple of ways. One is make sure you're consistent both in who you are portraying... I think you kind of have, and this is something that my therapist advises, kind of having almost like seeing social media as a persona, as being something that you go, right, that is that John McGreevy that is on Twitter is a thing. It isn't me, it's a thing. It's kind of, sure, it's based on me, it's a version of me, but it's not who I am. And so by consistency, I think kind of that relates to both how often you post things like that, but also what you're posting about, tone. Like if your whole thing is kind of making cynical jokes about a certain thing, cool. But then if you then go, oh, but here's my 10 favorite things about puppy dogs, you probably get a confused reaction and thing. But like I find that the only time I really grow my following is when I consistently post things or at least reply to things, like interacting with people as well, because a lot of people forget that it's not just about posting, it's about interacting and engaging. And
building relationships with people as well. It's having a network.
Exactly. You're having conversations.
Sorry, I'm butting in now.
No.
Because thinking, like, coming back to likes and everything, when I did that cruise tweet, I gained nearly 300 new followers. Hmm. And the visits to my website shot up in the hundreds. But did I gain any new clients? No. No leads, nothing. So that was just curiosity. And something somebody said about how, especially with reference to LinkedIn, but I think this applies to other social media platforms, it's not about the likes and saying the one thing, even if it happens by accident, that everybody, oh, look at this. Let's all plough into her profile and have a look. It's about people can be watching you from the curtains but not interacting with you. That's maybe a potential client. So consistency in how you interact with people is important. Somebody who's always watching. And you could have maybe two people engage with you that are potential businesses, but they could turn into leads and then turn into clients. So being consistent and doing what you do, it doesn't have to be about the likes and being popular and having thousands of followers. It can just be about being true to your brand and consistently building relationships and being who you are, and you could be in the right place at the right time and gain clients. It's not, you know, people try to be popular or try clickbait or try to be controversial, but it doesn't necessarily lead you anywhere.
Yeah, I'm kind of stuck. I was just Alex is probably there in his producer mind going, we've gone quite a lot longer than we normally try and go for. But
I enjoyed it.
Yeah, but that's the thing. I've kind of went, I'll have to deal with that in the edit. I don't care. It's having a good chat. Because what you touched upon then is something that, sorry, Alex, I'm just going to keep talking. This is, you know, fuck you.
I had a question about it, but yeah, okay, fine.
No. Okay. So what I was going to say is that, so something that kind of I learned from, I think it was Dev Basu, like, so he's the founder of Power by Search, which is a SaaS marketing agency. Dev Basu, he's someone who, he told me about vanity metrics. I think that's exactly what you're talking about then, is vanity metrics. Likes, clicks, it's all well and good, but it doesn't matter if the quality is bad. You'd rather have one high quality lead click your, go to your website, than 300 low quality that won't hire you. It doesn't really, like, just having the highest reach doesn't make work or success. It's about, like you say, the right people. It's appealing to the right people, getting the right thing. You got all those new followers and likes and things, but you know, you don't, if you sold something through cruisers, you might have had a better chance of having, if you had like, here's a newsletter about why I hate cruisers every week, you'd probably have a bunch of subscribers now. But because it's, that's not what you do, it's kind of, you know, you kind of go, it's a vanity metric. It feels good. Is it particularly doing much for your business? Maybe not, but you know, it's still, it's a nice thing to happen.
Yeah, it's a bit of fun in the moment, isn't it?
Yeah.
So with regard to vanity metrics, that's a really challenging thing, especially in social media, that the content that you create might end up being curated by how many likes and reactions you're getting. How have you handled that personally? Because you're not writing about cruisers, even though you've had a shoot through of like interactions and things like that. How do you kind of like make sure that you're staying true to the path you want to lead on Twitter? Because you post so many different things. How do you like balance that?
I try to balance it by talking about business and stuff when I can remember to, you know, as much as I can. But I've had to do an awful lot of turning inwards and accepting that as an autistic person, I have a lot of different interests and I can bounce from things all the time, and I just have to go with it and accept that. I know if that I woke up tomorrow morning and said, I must only tweet about business, it'll last a week if I'm lucky.
Yeah.
Before I got bored, I might say random things, but I think the essential thing is everyone knows I'm a copywriter. I'm a bit lefty. I have a great autistic community. I'm a liberal, and I try to be a decent human being, and people like working with me when they do, and that's great, and that is, has to be enough.
Yeah,
people get a glimpse into who I am, but I'm not just constantly talking about business, because you know.
I guess it comes down to stories in a way. You're kind of telling your story in the way that kind of you that makes sense to you, and that you want, and you feel comfortable sharing.
Yeah, what I'm comfortable sharing with people, and not oversharing, and not also being too dry and humourless.
Yeah,
so I just nearly went into a fugue then thinking about it.
Right. So to wrap this up, what we like to do quite often to people is ask a nice simple question, and basically ask you to get your crystal ball out. What is the future of SaaS marketing?
To be more human and more people orientated, and to just be funnier and kinder and cleverer and smarter, and not be too dry and humorless. To write for people, not other tech people.
Yeah, I mean, that's a, I
sounds
agree.
Lovely.
Because the world is changing rapidly, and we all have to change with it. And hope to God that we're all still here a year from now, she says cheerfully.
100%. I mean, that's, well, I mean, and what a message to end on is, you know, fingers crossed, yeah. Exactly.
Like, it was like 95% of this wholesome kind of hug, kind of like style thing, and then the 5% was it. But yeah, unending dread, a little bit there. I like that.
If we make it another year,
or another week, who knows?
Right, that's a good.
Oh, sorry, Karen.
That's a good closing kind of thing. It's like, what the future of SaaS is like. We need to do all this, and then it's like, you know, if SaaS still exists in this year of the apocalypse. I kind of like that kind of balance that's gone on.
So many unprecedented events now, they're practically weekly. it's also, in a way, I feel more of a sense of a community.
Mm.
This is affecting all of us, not just here in the UK, although we seem to be suffering more than usual. But, you know, it's everybody.
Yeah.
Come together. We can come through this. We can hold on to each other, and SaaS can be part of that improvement and getting better and coming out of the dark, and just it can all be good.
Mm. Wow. That's an amazing sentence. I love that. Coming out of the dark is one of the most inspiring things we've ever had in this podcast, for sure. That's undoubtedly. Well, Jill, thank you so much for coming on. This has been a lovely chat. We went way over our time because we had so much fun and learned so much and could listen to you talk all day. Thank you so much. No problem. That is our pleasure. So where can people find you? What's your Twitter handle, URL, anything else?
My Twitter handle is at Gillianography. Clement is there. Where else am I? My website's in my bio there. LinkedIn, it's Gillian Jones Brand Storytelling. I can post you the link to my LinkedIn profile later if that's any help.
We'll be able to grab them. We'll be able to put them in the show notes so anyone listening can get them there. Great.
Mostly on Twitter.
Yeah, brilliant. So if in doubt, Twitter. Thank you. Yeah, again, thank you again so much. We really appreciate you coming on, and it's been fantastic.
Thank you.
Well, that was a fantastic chat with Jill. We hope you enjoyed it. Very kind of, it covered a lot of kind of topics that we've not covered before. I think kind of talking about neurodivergence, things like that, is something that we've not talked about much. We've touched on it in like intros before, I think, but not really kind of delved into it with a guest before. So that was really good. And just great, great chat. So Alex, where can people find you?
You can find me at Alex Makes Songs, or you can visit our website, as our episodes are kind of created by our company, which is knockthemicproductions.com. Or is it knock? It's knockthemic.com. Not like the Knock the Mic Productions. It's just Knock the Mic. Take two. Visit us at knockthemic.com. Sorry, I panicked at speed and.
Cool. Well, thanks for sharing that, Alex.
God.
And you can find me at That Writer John on Twitter. I think I'm That Writer John on LinkedIn, or just search John McGreevy. And you can find me at johnmcgreevy.com if you need an email strategist. Thank you very much for listening. See you next time. Ta-ra.
Bye.